Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more. Straight talk. No nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
August 5th, 2015. Good morning, Talking Law fans. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan, just east of the Freedom Tower on this beautiful August summer day in New York City. This is our 40th show. That's a lot of shows. 40 shows. Thank you for supporting us. I'm going to have news about the show after we speak to our guest today. We're going to have Barry Maness. Barry Maness is going to join us to speak about the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action entered into on July 14th, 2015 in Vienna, otherwise known as the Iran nuke deal, which President Obama is feverishly lobbying Congress to support so he can override a veto so that the accord can go forward. We're going to get Barry Maness's thoughts on this in a moment. I want to welcome everybody back from vacation. I had a great summer vacation. After we speak to Barry Maness, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about it. I'll tell you about some of the different things that I am doing outside of the law and what direction I want to take this podcast in the future. But before we get to Barry Maness, and I will introduce him properly in just a second, our question of the day is, question, should Congress approve or oppose the nuclear deal with Iran entered into by the Obama administration, China, France, Germany, Russia, the UK, and the EU, and supported by UN resolution? That's the big question. President Obama is going to be making a big speech today at American University in Washington on this issue. This is timely, and I'm sure that in tomorrow's Republican presidential debate on Fox News, this will be a big issue as well. So let me give Barry Maness a proper introduction. Barry Maness is a former Goldman Sachs partner who spent 20 years as a Wall Street research analyst and head of research. He spent 3 years in Hong Kong. This man has been around the block. He knows of what he speaks. Mr. Maness became co-head of global investment research upon his return to Goldman in New York in 2001 and retired from the firm in 2004. In 2011, Barry co-founded Samuel Capital Management LLC, which manages a hedge fund capitalizing on opportunities in the municipal bond market. Since 2002, Barry has been actively engaged as a volunteer pro-Israel political activist, developing close relationships with House and Senate members, advising them on issues affecting the U.S.-Israel relationship, and speaking with audiences around the country on both policy and political issues relevant to the bilateral relationship. Since 2005, he has served on the board of directors of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, otherwise known as IPAC, and has occupied several senior lay leadership posts for the organization. He is also the past chair of APAC's investment committee. Now, I want to make something clear. The opinions expressed on this show by Barry Maness are his own. Individually, they do not represent the views of APAC, or any other organization. This talk is between Barry Maness and Dan Hochheiser, does not represent the views of any organization. So without further ado, I want to see if we have Barry Maness on the air. Barry, are you with me?
Yes, good morning, Dan. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I am real excited to have you on the program. You are so knowledgeable about these issues concerning the deal that has been struck among the United States, allies of the United States, and some who aren't really allies, and Iran, the nuclear accord, the agreement, which, Barry, I really wanted to kill myself yesterday as I was reading this 159 pages, which even for a lawyer is pretty much inaccessible because it refers to 400 annexes and laws and international treaties, and we really need you to help us understand the agreement. So before we get into the meat of the agreement, maybe you can give us some background about what the state of affairs was with Iran in terms of sanctions before this accord was born.
Sure, Dan. To start with some background, of course, one can't help but start in 1979. At the time of the Iranian Revolution, of course, the taking of American hostages in our own embassy territory in Tehran. And from that moment until now, of course, it's been a relationship of discord between the United States and Iran that has manifested itself in numerous different ways and not always directly between the two countries. And I start by stressing that because we're going to speak about sanctions in this conversation, and it's important to understand that over the interim 30-plus years, the United States, frequently acting with partners and allies, has levied sanctions on Iran for a variety of bad behaviors: support of terrorism, support of proliferation of conventional weapons in an already dangerous region and, in fact, around the world, and, of course, ultimately, its pursuit of nuclear weapons and the capability to build them. So starting with that as background, I think began to turn the tide and lead toward the negotiation that led to this agreement is that over the course of the period primarily between 2005 and 2011, as it became clear that Iran was violating an increasingly stringent series of United Nations Security Council resolutions designed to constrain its nuclear weapons ambition, and as it was clearly disregarding enforcement of those resolutions, increasingly the U.S. Congress began passing laws that further stiffened, in order to create leverage, the economic sanctions on Iran. And I want to mention the passage of one particular set of sanctions, because we'll come back and speak about them again, Dan. And that was at the end of 2011, at a time by which sanctions had been put in place on Iran's ability to export oil, of course, by far its biggest stream of both foreign currency and revenue in general. Those sanctions were already in place, but by the end of 2011, sanctions were put in place that severely constrained Iran's access to the international financial system and also put in place punishments for other banks around the world in third-party countries, let's say Europe and Asia, who would be interacting and engaging with Iranian banks, such that a choice began to emerge for companies around the world. You can do business with Iran, or you can do business in the United States. Or, similarly, you can do business in Iran, or you can do business in U.S. dollars. And that, for most companies around the world, is, of course, a very simple choice to make. And when the sanctions were put in place on the financial system that made that choice so stark, Dan, that's when the tipping point came, and the impact on Iran's economy of these sanctions really significantly expanded. And ultimately, this is what brought the Iranians to the negotiating table, beginning at first secretly between the U.S. and Iran over the course of 2012, and ultimately by the end of that year in the creation of the first temporary agreement that ultimately led to this agreement that was announced last month. So that's the background here. Economic pressure put in place to discourage illegal moves toward nuclear weapons capabilities.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking to pro-Israel activist Barry Maness about the Iran nuclear deal, which President Obama is going to speak about today at American University in Washington, D.C. Barry, so let's talk about what was happening in Iran in, let's say, 2012 to 2014. What was the state of their economy? What was going on in their society, which you believe caused them to come to the table to discuss an agreement?
Sure. And in so doing, I want to cite another important point in time, Dan, very relevant to this conversation, which was 2009. We'll all remember that in June 2009, an election was held in Iran. One must put that word in quotes, of course, in the case of Iran, where those who are allowed to run in an election are handpicked by a committee that is in turn handpicked by the supreme leader. But as the public reaction to the result of those elections, we will all remember protests in the streets, significant violence by the government of Iran against anybody who was dissenting, the publicly declared outcome of the election, which is typical in this very repressive theocratic country. And at that was a key moment because I believe that the Iranian leaders, for the first time since the revolution, saw the potential mortality of their regime before their eyes in June and July of 2009, and their determination to hold on to power, no matter how threatened they may become, was redoubled at that time, an undercurrent that's important for us to remember relative to this conversation. So going back to your question, by 2011 and 12, the state of the Iranian economy was going south. Energy prices that had always been very heavily subsidized for citizens of Iran were now starting to rise. The government simply couldn't afford to pay the subsidies anymore. There were a series of gas stations torched around Tehran at around that time. So real economic unrest that was leading to a second round of pressure on the regime just a couple of years after the demonstrations that I referred to a moment ago. So this was the backdrop, and this is what, for the first time, led the Iranians to be willing to respond to what was then a secret overture from the United States government to try to reach some sort of a negotiated accommodation.
And what was the evolution, as far as you understand, from this secret backroom channel between the United States and Iran, which gave birth to this agreement, which includes on one side the United States, the United Kingdom, the Russian Federation, Germany, France, China, and the European Union? How did the United States garner all that support from all those other actors?
Well, once the initial, once there was an understanding of a mutual desire to begin negotiations, although a mutual desire with very different understandings and objectives, as we will come back to, Dan, but once there was a mutual desire reached to begin negotiation, the U.S. was, of course, eager to work with our allies. And it should be said that this was not the first attempt at getting negotiations to go with Iran, so that other combinations of European countries had in the past reached out. So all of the parties that you just cited had some history before 2012 of trying to get engaged in negotiations with Iran. So the galvanizing of the UN and the leading countries in the world community with the United States, that was a relatively straightforward step. There was a strong desire, if possible, to reach a satisfactory conclusion. And I want to stress that word satisfactory, Dan, because at the outset of these negotiations, our government and all of the parties who you cited, the known collectively as the P5 plus one, all of those bodies collectively laid out a series of very clear objectives for the negotiation, basically what it would take. What it would take for us to begin relieving economic pressure on Iran. And my concerns, in a nutshell, come down to the fact that the very clearly and very frequently stated objectives at the beginning of the negotiations are simply not met by the terms of the agreement as it stands today.
And let's get to the terms of the agreement before we get to providing our opinions about whether this is a good deal or a bad deal so that people can really understand. I mean, broadly, I think if you read the media reports, even without reading the agreement, which unfortunately I did, and it was painful, as I told you before, but it took three cups of coffee. But in any event, I urge everybody to read the agreement. And actually, I posted a link to the agreement, which the Washington Post has the full text of the agreement on their website, which I posted on my Twitter feed. So if you go to Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, Hochheiser, you can see the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, 14 July 2015, all 159 pages of technical legalese and science and other stuff, which good luck getting through, but everybody should give it a try at least so you can understand it. So my understanding before I read the agreement, which was confirmed by reading it, was that basically the P5 plus one, their goal was to limit Iran's capacity to wage nuclear war or to stop them completely from getting a nuclear weapon. And Iran's motivation for entering into the agreement, as you've described so eloquently, was to loosen the noose around Iran's neck, which are the sanctions, which are really choking Iran's economy. But break down the elements of the deal as plainly as you can so people really understand, what does the P5 plus one get? What does Iran get?
Sure. And I think the best way to do that, Dan, is to look at the key components of the deal relative to the objectives stated at the outcome by our government and the P5 plus one collectively. I think that's the best lens with which to do so. So let's go through some key elements in that regard. Number one, the critical and overarching objective that our government laid out, and I should specify that it was not only the executive branch, but also the Congress in overwhelming numbers that on numerous occasions laid out in black and white that we were all on the same page in terms of these objectives. The first and most important overarching one was to block Iran's ability to develop a nuclear weapon, to leave Iran without the capability to do so in a way that would be entirely verifiable and could be confirmed at any moment. So let's start there. If you look at nothing else but the duration of the agreement, the duration of the agreement alone essentially contradicts that important overarching objective that we had from the outset, because whatever it is that we may discuss and interpret with respect to the terms of the agreement along the way, one way or another, at the end of 15 years from this agreement, Iran will have the ability to develop nuclear weapons with no constraints. So the first and most important overarching objective that I believe contradicts the most important objective that we had was that Iran can, without any violation of the agreement, can have a clear path to developing nuclear weapons beginning in 15 years. Dan, that is simply way too soon.
Barry, let me just interject because I want to delve further into that point, the duration of the agreement. And as a lawyer who read the agreement, it's even difficult to figure out exactly what the duration is, because you'll see 15 years, you'll see 10 years, you'll see 8 years. There are lots of periods in the agreement, and they're cross-references.
Well, Dan, I'm alluding to the longest duration, because you're correct that there are aspects that I'm concerned about that become concerns in even shorter periods, and we'll get to some of those. But even if you only look at the longest definition of the enforcement of the agreement, then I encourage the listeners to think about their children or grandchildren, if you have them. Add 15 years to the current ages of your children and grandchildren, and think about where they will be in life 15 years from now, and imagine the influence that Iran will have in the world. It will have the influence of those countries you listed earlier, Dan, in the P5 plus one. It will have that stature, and may not have a Security Council resolution veto as those countries have, but it will have an effective veto relative to its insidious interests around the world and spreading them 15 years from now.
Barry, the agreement talks about four different days: finalization day, adoption day, transition day, termination day. Can you shed some light on what those days mean for the listeners so we can understand the timing and the procedural posture of this agreement?
I think the best way to do that is just to speak about what occurs at different time frames, Dan.
Sure.
And the first and soonest and most important of those, which would lead to my second concern, we're starting to get from the overarching into the more specific concerns now. But the second concern I have relates to the first event to occur under the agreement, which is the lifting of the sanctions on Iran, virtually all of them. And sanctions were put in place, as we discussed at the beginning, in order to create pressure. As the president has frequently and correctly said, it was the sanctions infrastructure that led the Iranians ultimately to come to the table and be willing to negotiate. And as the most important card that we held, and the card that we have to trade for ending their ability to get nuclear weapons, that this is a card that was meant to be traded. And I want to be clear that sanctions are meant to be relieved. They are put in place specifically for the purpose of eventually relieving them. So I don't have a concern per se with the idea of the sanctions being relieved and being relieved greatly and ultimately being relieved thoroughly. What concerns me greatly and completely violates and undermines the objective as we laid it out as a country, Dan, is the idea that the sanctions relief occurs first. Were the sanctions relief to occur over time, as we know that Iran was complying with aspects of its program and the commitments that it is making, and Iran is making commitments under this deal, and it's important that we come back and specify those, but whether those things actually occur, they will occur after the money is in Iran's pocket, Dan. And after, as you put it, the noose around the neck has already been removed. So my biggest concern in the specifics is that the relief comes up front.
Yeah, and Barry, let me use an analogy if I might. It seems to me, as somebody who's not an expert on Middle Eastern or United States foreign affairs, but it seems to me that what happens in this agreement with the releasing sanctions first without proof of any compliance by Iran in terms of their nuclear program is akin to me putting an addition on my house and hiring a contractor to put the addition on my house and paying the contractor 100% of the contract price before he even does one bit of work. And nobody would do that even with a legitimate contractor, because you want to make sure there's compliant with the contract to put the addition on your house. Am I wrong?
That's right, except it's worse, Dan. Imagine that that contractor had a record of violation of delivering on contractual obligations. Now we're starting to make it more similar.
And so let me play the devil's advocate for a bit, because you and I don't think it's any secret to the listener, on the same sides of this issue. We both don't believe in this agreement, and we both oppose it, and I'll give you an opportunity to explain a little bit more than you have already why. But, this is what my mother said. My mother's a big lefty, a big liberal, and she says, well, you know, this seems to limit their nuclear program. This seems to be the best of the available options. If we don't enter into this agreement, then we're going to have no control over them, and they're just going to do whatever they want, and they'll build a nuclear weapon, et cetera. So how do you respond to my mother, who I love, but she's a liberal? It's probably not her fault.
Well, I love your mother too, and this is, and I want to start by stressing that this is not and should not be a liberal versus conservative debate. And there is a political debate going on in Washington. We will get to talking about that, and the important vote Congress will take in early September. And of course, I'm well aware that if you look at how the early inclinations on that debate are lining up, they largely correlate with party, but it should not be the case, Dan. Every one of us should be analyzing the merits of this deal relative to American security and relative to whether we believe we gain more or risk more in our national security and that of our allies by supporting this deal. And I don't believe that that is or should be a liberal versus conservative issue. But to get back to your mom's main point, there are commitments that Iran is making under the transaction. The concern I have is that they're simply not enough. they are too much of the relief up front in terms of the sanctions, as I mentioned too, and also the path that the series of timelines creates. And what I mean by that is it's not only dangerous that Iran gets the sanctions relief up front. It's the continuum of the steps that Iran could take between the sanctions relief in just a few months and the freedom to do whatever they wish in 15 years down the road that I alluded to earlier. In between, some other critical steps occur. Number one, 5 years from now under the agreement, in a clause that was added, by the way, in just the last few days of negotiations, at Iran's demand and Iran's urging, our side agreed to waive the UN resolutions that embargo the delivery of conventional weapons and the sale of conventional weapon systems to Iran, and to do so in 5 years. So think about that, and think about the threat that Iran, as the sponsor of Hezbollah, Hamas, and other terrorist groups around the region, including now in Yemen, and the ability that Iran will have to funnel large amounts of conventional weapons to those groups in 5 years' time. So in the first several months, Iran will get over $100 billion in cash. In 5 years, Iran will have the ability to buy conventional weapons around the world unfettered. In 8 years, a second waiving of a current embargo will occur, and that is on any systems that can be used for the development of intercontinental ballistic missiles, which currently cannot be sold to Iran. That, too, will be waived in something else that was acceded to in the final days of the negotiation. In 8 years, so money in the first year, ability to buy conventional weapons unfettered in the fifth year, ability to buy intercontinental ballistic missiles that can reach where all of our listeners are sitting right now on an unfettered basis in 8 years, and ultimately along the way, the ability to continue doing research on advanced centrifuges, so the ability to build nuclear weapons in a more efficient way is facilitated, to finally in the point in 15 years where all restrictions would come off, and all of the above could be done with the blessing of approval of the world community. That's what concerns me, and that's my response to your mom.
You're listening to Talking Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with pro-Israel activist Barry Manis about the Iran nuclear agreement reached with the P5 plus one, which includes the United States, the UK, Russia, Germany, France, China, and the EU. There's been a lot of heat and a lot of talk, a lot of coverage about the dangers that this agreement could present to Israel, because Israel is a tiny country. You have Lebanon and Hezbollah to the north. You have Hamas in Gaza, and it's real immediate in Israel. But what I want to talk about is not the danger to Israel, but the danger to America that this accord presents, in your opinion. Why should Americans be concerned about their safety if this accord is passed, approved by Congress, or opposed by Congress, and vetoed by the president, and then the Congress override, and then the president's veto. Excuse me, the president vetoes, and then the veto is sustained in the Congress. So why should Americans be concerned about this agreement? Why is it imminent here as well?
Americans should be concerned, Dan, because of what the timeline I just described would allow Iran to do relative to who Iran is. So let's take a moment and remember. I referred back to 1979. For some of the listeners who are a couple years younger than you and I, that may seem like a long time ago. But from 1979 until now, it has been nothing but a series of anti-American violence and anti-American calls to violence and destruction by Iran and proxy groups that it supports around the world. Let's remember that it was Iran who was the biggest supplier of explosive devices that killed and maimed American soldiers in both Iraq and Afghanistan. So if you know an Iraq War veteran or Afghanistan veteran, ask them about the dangers that the IEDs, which our government years ago established, were almost 100% built, supplied from Iran into those countries for the express purpose of killing and maiming American soldiers. An explosive device that could penetrate armor and did on many occasions in those two conflicts. So whether it was those, or whether it's Iran's support for terrorist groups, or Dan, whether it's the fact that as recently as a few days after the agreement was reached, not before it was reached, but just a few days after the agreement was reached, the supreme leader of Iran, with the entire leadership of the country, stood behind him at a parade in Tehran with a rifle in his hand, to leave nothing to doubt, leading the chance of death to America. Death to America before death to Israel, as you alluded to. America is the great Satan. Israel is only the little Satan that is seen as the offspring of America in Iranian eyes. Americans should all be very concerned about the combination of means and intent that this transaction will give to this regime.
You're listening to Talking Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with Barry Maness about the Iran-United States and other countries' nuclear accord. Barry, do you have 10 more minutes to spend with us? Because I have many more questions for you, but I don't want to interfere with your schedule if you have to run.
Sure do, Dan.
Great. So, you know, you talked about the dangers to America and how our United States veterans have experienced the pain of Iranian support for terrorism. But where are the veterans groups? Have the veterans groups in America been speaking up against this agreement?
It's been mixed, as in a lot of constituencies. And I think that the desire to just kind of hold things where they are now, not have some components get significantly worse in the short term, which I think would be a fair characterization of the transaction. It holds certain components where they are now. They won't deeply worsen in the short term unless there's noncompliance in the short term. And I want to say, by the way, that I do not expect flagrant noncompliance of this agreement by Iran. I would anticipate marginal noncompliance to test the limits of what can be gotten away with. But Iran really does not have a reason to take the risk of gross violations of this agreement, because it's that good an agreement for them that they're far better off poking and prodding where they can and then simply waiting it out to have unfettered capabilities down the road rather than violating it significantly in the short term.
So, Barry, let's talk about the votes in Congress. The certain congressmen and women have publicly opposed the agreement, and some have been silent. We have, for example, I believe Nita Lowey came out yesterday, a congresswoman from New York, from near the area you and I live in. She opposed it. Also, I believe that Congresswoman Kathleen Rice opposed it yesterday. She used to be the district attorney in Nassau County in New York. I believe that Representative Ted Deutsch from Florida, who's on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, came out against it, and some others. But what's really of concern to me is Senator Charles Schumer, the senior senator from New York, has been so silent, it's deafening. And my congressman, Elliot Engel, as far as I understand, has not come out publicly and opposed the deal, and he's usually a big ally of Israel and, you know, really looks out for the interests of America and American Jews in particular.
All right. So before we get into some of those particulars, and all the facts you just stated are accurate, Dan, let's just give a moment of background on the political debate that's now taking place with the agreement, as we discussed it, having been reached. So back in April, Congress passed a law that would give them the right to pass to take a vote of approval or disapproval relative to any deal that would be reached. And that bill was passed overwhelmingly, and the president, who initially was opposed to the idea of Congress taking that vote, when he saw that there was really broad bipartisan demand by Congress, that as the representatives of the people, they should have a say on something of this national importance, the White House then embraced the legislation, asked for some changes to it, an agreement was reached, and overwhelmingly, a bill was passed that would give Congress the right to vote on an agreement. And the way that that was structured was that Congress would get some window of time to consider the agreement, to read it as you did, Dan, and review all the details, consult experts before taking a vote. We are now in that period. We are now about 10 days to 2 weeks into what will be a 60-day period that law gave Congress in order to review the deal, and we anticipate that Congress will take a vote sometime in the week coming out of Labor Day, probably sometime around September 9th, 10th, somewhere in that range. As you alluded to at the outset, Dan, the president has already publicly said that if Congress votes to disapprove of the deal, that he will veto that measure. He will veto the measure of disapproval. That's broadly anticipated, and therefore, the real challenge for those who are opposed to the deal is to try to get to votes of two-thirds or more, because while the initial vote would not be an override vote of a veto, presumably it's a proxy for what would eventually be an override vote. So the battle that's taking place right now is that the administration and supporters of the deal are trying to hold on to at least one-third of both the House and Senate. Opponents of the deal, including myself, are trying to garner the support of two-thirds of both the House and the Senate. And as you said, names are starting to be posted, both in the for and against column, as members of Congress begin to come out. I think one of the most notable things I'd say first, Dan, is that the total number of senators and House members who at this stage, a couple of weeks into the discussion, have declared in either way remains very low. I think that's the first observation to consider. As you said, more are coming out every day, but considering how intensely the White House lobbied, in particular Democratic members, to come out publicly in favor of the transaction before they all went home on their recess, which both the Senate and the House have now done, the number who have come out in either direction is actually strikingly low. And what that tells me is that members of Congress are being very responsible about this. They're taking the time to consider it seriously. And also because we are now into the August recess, that the input from folks back home is ultimately what is going to determine how the vast majority of members of Congress vote when they come back in September. And therefore,
so Barry,
I would encourage listeners. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think this is where you're going, Barry, but I want to ask the question. You know, one of the things I did as an American citizen is when there's an issue I feel passionately about, I want to make my voice heard. And what I did was I called Senator Chuck Schumer's office and registered my opposition to the Iran deal with his office, making it clear that I opposed it and wanted him to oppose the deal. And I did the same with a phone call the other day to my Congressman Elliot Engel's office, and not only told his office that I wanted him to oppose the deal, but that I wanted him to come out publicly. So what can the average American citizen do who's not a lawyer, not a politician, not a celebrity? What can they do to fight for this issue, whichever way they are on it? What can they do? What action can they take?
They should call their elected representative, as you've done, Dan, and ask them not only to make a determination to be opposed to the agreement and simply say and to them that this agreement is not good enough for the risks that it takes with our security, the terms and what we are getting back, the idea of the relief up front, the idea of the path toward having the combination of the intent and the means on Iran's part, not necessarily to use nuclear weapons, of course, ultimately our greatest concern, but to proliferate other kinds of violence, to perhaps give nuclear capability to other terrorist groups, that the risk we are taking for what we're getting in return is simply not enough, and importantly, Dan, that what you would like your elected officials Council to do is to, in voting to disapprove of the deal, not say that the entire concept should be thrown out the window, but to urge the administration to go back to the table using economic leverage that we still retain and to negotiate a better deal. There is a better deal that is possible here, Dan, and that's important to stress. So coming back to your question about the politics, the first thing I want to say is that anybody who cares about this issue and is concerned about this deal should take a moment to thank the brave members of Congress who have already come out and said they're against it. And I'm going to quickly mention their names. They are Representative Vargas from California, Representative Grace Meng from New York, Congressman Alberto Cires from New Jersey. You referred to Ted Deutch and Nita Lowey and Kathleen Rice in your comments. All of those members, all of them Democrats who have come out and said they will vote against it, should be called and thanked. That's number one. Number two, our senators, starting with Senator Schumer, because of the great influence that he has as the incoming leader of the Democratic Conference in the Senate, we should be calling him and saying, where are you? Where is your voice? You signed on to every letter and resolution that clearly laid out what the objectives of this negotiation needed to be. They're not met by this deal. Where are you? Where is your voice? We need to know where you are. Now, you referred to Congressman Engel, who's your congressman and mine, Dan. I want to be clear that the call there is a different call. Congressman Engel has indicated privately to numerous people that he will vote against the deal. The problem is, as the ranking member on the Foreign Affairs Committee, the top Democrat on foreign affairs issues in the Congress, number one, he has great influence over the vote of others. You correctly pointed out that he has a long history and record of being one of the strongest supporters of the U.S.-Israel alliance and issues that affect it. But even more broadly than that, he is the top Democrat in the House of Representatives on foreign issues. We need him to publicly indicate his opposition, to indicate publicly that he will be using his influence to try to convince others who respect his views on foreign affairs to vote against it. That's the call that we need to be making to Congressman Engel.
And the call I'm going to make right now is for Congressman Engel to come on Talkin' Law with Dan Hochheiser to make that announcement public that he opposes this deal. So, Congressman Engel, if you're listening, I invite you on the show. Barry Manis, thank you so much for your expert analysis. This was a pleasure. I hope you will come back and join us soon. And I'll see you in Shul.
Nice to be with you, Dan. Thanks for the time. And listeners, take the time to pick up the phone. Call your senators. Call your members of Congress. Thank you.
Hey, Barry, before you leave, is there... Barry?
Yes.
Yeah, is there a way that listeners can get in touch with you if they want to do work in activism to oppose this deal?
Yes, via you would be the best way to do it, Dan.
Okay, so reach out to me at talkinlaw@gmail.com to reach Barry if you're interested. Barry Manis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dan.
All right, Talkin' Law fans. Now, we have an extended show for you today because I have some news I want to share with you, and I have been away for a month. And I know you missed me, and I missed you, so whether you're listening to this on the train or in the car or waiting for a bus or at home, in the office, wherever you are, I don't know where you are. I know where I am. I'm in downtown Manhattan. In any event, that was a great discussion with Barry Manis. Let's answer the question of the day. Question. Should Congress approve or oppose the nuclear deal with Iran entered into by the Obama administration, China, France, Germany, Russia, the United Kingdom, and the European Union, and supported by UN resolution? Answer. Congress should oppose this deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, because the lifting of sanctions, as Barry pointed out, would permit Iran access to billions of dollars of new capital with which Iran could finance terrorist organizations like Hezbollah and Hamas and other bad actors overseas and right here at home in the United States. Iran is a nation going back to 1979. Remember, we had hostages. Is a nation committed to the annihilation of the United States, ally Israel. and will use the new funds flowing into Iran to work towards its goal of wiping Israel off the map. The agreement expires after 15 years, at which time Iran will be in a position to seek a nuclear weapon with the blessing of the world. Now, we should not make deals with terrorist states, which is exactly what Iran is. Like Barry Manis said, call your congressman, call your senator, tell them you oppose this deal. It's a bad deal. Opposing the deal does not mean we're going to go to war with Iran, continue to tighten the sanctions against Iran, which we're working. We know they're working because that's the only reason that this terrorist country was begging to come to the table with the United States. So keep choking Iran with the sanctions, say no to the deal, and we will be safer in the United States, and our ally Israel will also be safer. Now, this is our 40th show. It's hard to imagine, but I've hosted 39 of those shows. Beth Karras hosted one show for me very well. That was a great show she did. And, our ratings have been good, but I want the show to grow. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to change the name of the show from Talkin' Law with Dan Hochheiser to Talkin' with Dan Hochheiser. Why am I doing this? I think it's important that we broaden our audience so that the show remains alive and growing and it reaches as many listeners. I'm afraid that the law part of the title of the show maybe turns some people off from trying the show or listening to the show because they say, I'm not a lawyer, I don't want to listen to it. So we're going to call the show from now on Talkin' with Dan Hochheiser, and that will allow us to talk about anything we want. We're still going to talk about law, but we're also going to talk about politics. We're going to talk about current events. We're going to talk about comedy. We're going to talk about show business, podcasting. We're going to talk about anything yours truly is interested in, and I hope this will make the show more accessible to a broader audience. To date, we have had 17,866 listens. Thank you to all those thousands of listeners who have tuned in, who have enjoyed the shows, which have been remarkable, from a show we did with Alan Dershowitz to Alberto Gonzalez, who is a former Attorney General of the United States, to Congressman Grimm and Congressman Ney and former Congressman Barney Frank, and all kinds of great guests we have had on the show, including lawyers and celebrities, and that's going to continue. But I want to broaden the show, and one of the pieces of news I wanted to share with you is that I recently started to do stand-up comedy. And that's not a joke, even though it sounds like it might be a joke. But, how did that happen? How does a lawyer, a middle-aged lawyer married with kids, decide one day he's going to do stand-up comedy? Well, I have always been interested in comedy, and I was listening to a podcast, a very excellent podcast called Industry Standard with Barry Katz. Barry Katz, if you get word of this, I'd love to have you on the show. I love his podcast, and he has all kinds of comedians and people in Hollywood on his shows, agents, producers, directors. And a friend of mine said, Dan, I didn't know you were interested in comedy. And I said, yeah, I've always been interested in comedy. You know, always been a fan of the greats, from Woody Allen, Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy back in the day. Even Andrew Dice Clay was so funny, even though he's dirty. Today, Louis C.K. and Bill Burr and Amy Schumer, and they're hilarious. And when my friend said to me, you ever think about trying comedy? My first reaction was, are you kidding me? I'm a lawyer. What are you talking about? And being the insane guy I am, not legally insane, just insane, I said to myself, you know what? Life is short. Maybe I should. And a couple of days later, I wrote some stuff. I went to an open mic at Stand Up New York on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and I performed for the first time. And the first time I performed, I bombed. Total silence. Complete silence. But I liked it. So I kept doing it. And I started to have better sets, and people started to laugh. And I actually, as you know, I had a comedian on the show before I went on summer vacation, Alex Barnett, who is a lawyer who became a comedian. And I had him on the show, and we got together, and he introduced me to Low Hud Comedy, which produces comedy in Westchester County, Rockland County, in New York, and elsewhere. And I actually did my first professional comedy show on July 30th at Molly Spillane's in Mamaroneck, New York, my hometown, with great comedians Adam Oleensis, Alex Barnett, Alan Thin, George Salt, and Mark Kay. We put on a show to a packed house at Molly Spillane's in Mamaroneck. I want to publicly thank Molly Spillane's for having us. I want to thank Low Hud Comedy. And it was such a big success, and people had such a good time and laughed so hard that Molly Spillane's invited us back. We're going to do a second show due to popular demand on August 27th. Doors will open at 7 p.m. Molly Spillane's, 211 Mamaroneck Avenue in Mamaroneck, New York. You can get your tickets for $20 each at lohudcomedy.com. That's L-O-H-U-D comedy.com. The comics for the second show on August 27th will include some of the same comics from the first show, and we're going to mix in some new blood, as far as I understand, including Mick Diflo, who I understand is extremely funny. So for $20, you get to have some laughs. You get to have, you'll get some cocktails, which is obviously not included in the $20. But come on, buck up, people. This is New York. But a night, it's a great date night. You should come out. August 27, 2015, you can see me perform stand-up comedy at Molly Spillane's in Mamaroneck, and get your tickets at lohudcomedy.com. Please get your tickets early. They're more expensive at the door if you just show up. And last show was sold out, so please get your tickets early. So that's the comedy news. And, you know, people ask me, well, what do you talk about in your comedy routine? I talk about lots of stuff. I talk about my life. I talk about my parents. I talk about my wife. I talk about being a parent of three children. I talk about being Jewish. I talk about New York. I talk about the Yankees. I talk about all kinds of things. So I think you'll really enjoy the comedy. Go to lowhudcomedy.com. Get your tickets. You will not be disappointed. So that's sort of big news in my life. I wanted to share that with my faithful listeners. What else is going on? What else is going on is that tomorrow night, there's going to be two presidential Republican debates. Fox News is hosting two Republican presidential debates. In the main debate, you will hear Donald Trump, Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, Mike Huckabee, Ted Cruz, Mark Rubio, Rand Paul, Chris Christie, John Kasich, Ben Carson. Who is in the lesser debate? The lesser debate, the people who were not included on the varsity, these are the junior varsity debaters, will be Rick Perry, Bobby Jindal, Rick Santorum, Carly Fiorina, George Pataki, Lindsey Graham, and Jim Gilmore. I feel so bad for those, that group who didn't make the list, which was decided by, I think, a group of five national Republican polls, and they didn't have enough votes to get into the debate. But everybody, I think, is going to be tuning in to watch the Donald with the hair and the crazy talk do his thing. It will be interesting. As an American, I sincerely hope that Donald Trump does not become the next president of the United States. I believe he's a demagogue. I don't believe he's a very empathetic or compassionate person based on the statements he has made. And as a comedian, however, I hope he wins. As a comedian, I hope that Donald Trump picks Sarah Palin as his vice president. And I mean, imagine the late night TV, imagine Saturday Night Live. Imagine, Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel doing their thing late at night about Donald Trump and Sarah Palin. I mean, that would just be delicious for 4 years. But as an American, I hope it doesn't happen. It will be interesting to see how Jeb Bush, who was the putative front runner until Donald Trump took over this campaign, how he does in the debate. I was very disappointed, which I said on the air before I went on summer break, that I was very disappointed with Jeb Bush's flubbed response to the question about his brother's handling of the Iraq war. Had his brother had the information we have today, then you can go listen to all our past podcasts at blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw. And, who else is in that debate? I don't think Mike Huckabee is going to be the next president. Ted Cruz, I don't know. He scares me. He's a Tea Party guy. Mark Rubio, I don't know. Rand Paul, I think Rand Paul's a pretty good guy. He's a libertarian. He seems to have some guts. Chris Christie is not going to be president and shouldn't be president. He doesn't have the temperament. He's a bully. He rubs me and many other people the wrong way. And, I know he wasn't found responsible for that, traffic jam fiasco on the George Washington Bridge, but, you gotta look at the leader when the subordinates do bad things. And, it's always a top-down culture thing as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, you create a certain culture and, you know, if people do certain things below you, even if you don't know it's happening, you may not be technically responsible, but you may have breed that culture, which led to that corruption. John Kasich, he's a smart guy. He's a public servant. I don't have a problem with John Kasich. Ben Carson's a doctor. I think he should probably stick to being a doctor. He's not going to win. That's going to be the Republican presidential debate. What else did I want to talk to you folks about? Oh, my trip to Israel. Yeah, I went to Israel for 2 weeks earlier this summer. It was fantastic. If you haven't taken a trip to Israel recently and you have the means, if you have the money and the time to do so, I understand that not everybody does. I'm fortunate that I did. And it was fantastic. I got to go to the south and to see the sunrise from the top of Mount Masada, which was really unbelievable to see the sun reflecting off the Dead Sea, where the Jewish people hid from the Romans 2,000 years ago in Herod's fortress. That was really something. And if you come to our comedy show, I do a nice bit about Masada. I think you'll like it. We also went up north and rafted in the Jordan River. That was just awesome. We were all over. We were in Caesarea. We were in Herzliya at the beach, which is one of the nicest beaches in the world. And I've been to Hawaii and Miami and the Caribbean. And Herzliya is just, the sand is so soft and so gorgeous. I recommend it highly for anybody who wants to vacation. You should include that in your Israel trip. Go to Herzliya. And what else? Tel Aviv. I mean, bike riding on Rothschild Street. And going out at night in here, Armenian music was just so cool. It's such an old, cool part of Tel Aviv, Yafo is. And, of course, Jerusalem. You know, going to Jerusalem and just hanging out on Ben Yehuda Street, eating a pita shawarma, watching the people, hanging out, getting solicited by 400 people who want donations for this. It was just what an experience. And, you know, I'll end with this one little story. I went to the post office in Israel because I had to mail my 12-year-old daughter a care package. And this was really a humbling experience because while I can read Hebrew, I can't speak it and I can't write it. So when I went to the post office, I was really like a child and I needed the postal clerk to help me fill out the packing slip and all this, the address. And I think maybe that postal clerk stole the care package because my daughter never got it. But I guess that's my fault for not paying attention in Hebrew school. This is Dan Hochheiser signing off for Talking with Dan Hochheiser. I wish everybody peace and justice.